Welcome to NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John.
A God is every joy and inspiration. Tears are all I have to show. No consolation. All I see is grief and gloom. Till the crack of doom. Oh, melancholy mood.
That is Bob Dylan singing Melancholy Mood, a track from his new album, Fallen Angels, which came out on Friday. This is the second album in a row released by Dylan that features songs first recorded by Frank Sinatra. It's the latest twist in the remarkable artistic life of a man who was born Robert Allen Zimmerman 75 years ago today in Duluth, Minnesota. To mark that milestone birthday this hour, we're going to replay the documentary Boy from the North Country, Bob Dylan, in Minnesota. It was produced and narrated by NPR's Jim Bickle.
Bob Dylan's father, Abe Zimmerman, grew up in Duluth. In 1920, when he was 9 years old, one of the most disturbing incidents in the history of Duluth took place just a few blocks from where Abe was living. A traveling circus was in town, and six men who worked for the circus were arrested and accused of rape. As news of the arrest spread, an angry mob gathered in the street. They broke into the jail, and three of the men were hanged from a streetlight. Members of the lynch mob posed for a photograph with the bodies, which was printed and sold as a postcard. Years later, Abe Zimmerman's son would incorporate that story into his music.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row.
Bob Dylan's grandfather, Zygmunt Zimmerman, came to Duluth in 1906 from the city of Odessa in what is now the Ukraine, which was then Russia. He left Odessa soon after hundreds of Jews were killed in some of the worst anti-Semitic rioting that city had seen. His son, Abe, was born in Duluth. He got a job with Standard Oil, and he met a woman named Beattie Stone, and they got married. Their son, Robert Allen Zimmerman, was born May 24, 1941. And Duluth is where Bob Dylan spent the first 6 years of his life.
Oh, that's shaking the wonder and the phantoms of my youth. Rainy days on the Great Lakes, walking.
In 1946, Abe Zimmerman contracted polio. He survived, but was unable to continue working for Standard Oil. At the time, his two brothers were opening an electric appliance store in the Iron Range community of Hibbing. That's also where Abe's wife, Beattie, was from. And so they picked up the family and moved to Hibbing. That's where Bob Dylan met Leroy Hoikala when they were both 14 years old.
He was independent, impatient, and restless. He really was.
Hoikala says they would get together on a regular basis and see what downtown Hibbing had to offer.
Bob would say, let's go on a mission. And I'd go, okay. So let's do what we did last weekend. I'd go, all right. So we'd do the same thing and stop at the same places all the time. We'd stop at Carlson Shoe Repair and Hotel Music on First Avenue. And Bob would always look at the guitars. And I looked at the vibes, of course. So anyhow, then we go to Stephen's Grocery and we'd look at the magazines. He had a lot of magazines there.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
So we look at the magazines with James Dean, because James Dean was really one of our idols.
Well, he's real abstract. He's different.
That's right. I'm cute, too.
And he had his collar up. Well, the next day, everybody had their collars up, you know, including Bob.
Is that meaning me?
Is that meaning me?
What?
Chicken.
Yes. You shouldn't call me that.
Perhaps in an effort to broaden his horizons beyond what he could see in the movies and in downtown Hibbing, his family sent Bob to a summer camp in Wisconsin. It was started by the Twin Cities Jewish community, and that's where he met another camper by the name of Dick Cohn.
And one of the reasons these kids, especially from northern Minnesota or from other communities, would come to this camp because they didn't have a lot of Jewish socialization in their life, and it was just an opportunity for them to get some of that. And because of that, when these kids would come to the Twin Cities, Bob especially, we would have social dances, snowballs or mixers or whatever they called them. And so Bob would come to town quite frequently, actually, partially because of these events, but also just on other weekends. We would have these parties in people's homes, and Bob would show up at the party and play rock and roll music on the piano until the parents would come down and kick him out. And we would go from one party to the next, sort of. He was kind of the new kid who came in and blew the house away before we even knew what that meant. He just came in and surprised everybody and stopped the momentum of whatever was going on and changed the momentum to his music. And it was just very exciting. And so Bob would say to me when I'm on tour with him, he'd say, "So what'd you think of that concert?" And I say, "Bob, it was great, but it was not as good as when you played Baby Let Me Bang Your Box in Nancy's Basement."
Bob learned that song from a 1954 recording by the group called The Toppers.
"Well, my baby gave a party the other night. The party was getting dead. I spied a piano in the corner. Looked at my baby and said, 'Baby, let me bang your box. Baby, let me bang your box. Baby, let me play your head. Gonna play till the whole house rocks.'"
This is the kind of rhythm and blues music that Bob was discovering in record stores in the Twin Cities and hearing on late-night radio broadcasts that he could pick up in Hibbing. His high school friend John Buckland recorded some of those broadcasts. He also recorded conversations with Bob about music. In this recording from 1958, when he was 17, Bob offers his thoughts on who was copying who in the music industry.
I mean, you know, when you hear music like the Diamonds, take the Diamonds, for instance, they're on this big popular record, you know, so that they're popular, big stars. But where do they get all the songs? You know where they get all the songs? They get all the songs from little groups. They copy all the little groups. Same thing with Elvis Presley. Who does he copy? He copies Clyde McFatter. Listen, he copies Little Richard.
Wait a minute.
He copies the Drifters.
Wait a minute. Name four songs that Elvis Presley's copied from those little groups.
He copies all Little Richard songs.
Like
Rip
what?
It Up, Long Tall Sally, Really Teddy, what's the other one?
Money Honey?
No, Money Honey he copied from Clyde McFatter. He copied I Was the One, he copied that from the Coasters. He copied I Got a Woman from Ray Charles.
Now, at the time, Bob was copying the frenetic piano playing style of his rocking idol, Little Richard. He even composed a tribute to him. John Buckland captured it on his reel-to-reel recorder. Bob got to show off his piano playing abilities at several assemblies at the Hibbing High School. Nancy Peterson was a student at Hibbing High as well. She remembers one performance in particular.
Bob played the piano in the style of Jerry Lee Lewis. So standing and playing chords. And, you know, I don't remember having seen anything like that before. And I didn't quite know what to make of it. And for those of us who were, like, I was a 15-year-old high school student who had not heard music that sounded like Jerry Lee Lewis and rock and roll and so on before. And so I wanted to be cool. I didn't know whether I should like this stuff or hate it. It sounded very strange to me. And it occurs to me that it was probably the loudest music any of us had ever heard. Some students were adding to that by cheering loudly. And then I looked around and I saw that the teachers clearly hated it. Their body language just showed you that they were cringing or they had their arms folded. The teacher, a couple of rows in front of me, had her hands clasped over her ears to try to block it out. And that said to me, oh, yeah, this is cool. I should like this. So for at least that moment, you know, we all liked it. But that was the performance where the high school principal decided to shut it down. And so they closed the curtains.
So you remember that it was just, they was like, was kind of in the middle of the song or something that they actually closed
yes.
the
curtain? Yes, they were still performing and the curtains closed and they still performed for a while until somebody figured out how to cut the power to them.
Bob was in several bands when he was in high school. One of them was called the Golden Chords. That band started out with his old friend Leroy Hoikala on drums and guitarist Monty Edwardson. Hoikala recalls that he was walking down the street with Monty one day and they ran into Bob.
We were walking from the high school on a nice summer day down to our jobs, and Bob was going to Chuck Krippa's music store. And he said, hey, I hear you guys being jamming at Monty's. He said, why don't we jam in my garage? And we said, sure. So Monty and I said, oh, we'll see you Saturday. So we went over there Saturday and started playing, and Bob knew what he wanted. Even the drums, he said, keep it simple. He says, no pounding, keep it real quiet and simple. And he goes, okay, I can. That's easy to do. So anyway, that's how we kind of started. Monty played and Bob played. We were in the garage.
And they were both playing guitar then?
Yes, right. Monty's playing lead guitar and Bob was playing rhythm. And then I believe he had a harmonica with a real cheapy thing around his neck. It wasn't a real fancy one. And Bob would play some of these songs. I never heard of a lot of them because he's followed the stuff from rhythm and blues. And around here, I've never heard of rhythm and blues, you know. But and this is kind of funny because his mom was just a bubbly person. Really nice. Oh, she was a sweetheart. But she came out because it was attached garage kind of to the house in a way, through a hallway. And she came out and she'd say, Bobby, you know, this is getting kind of loud. And we do have neighbors, Bob. He go, yeah, Ma. I remember once after school, we're going to work, Monty, myself, and Bob was with us. And one of the neighbor kids hollered, hey, you guys going to practice in the garage this weekend? Bob said, what? We don't practice. We just play music. And a lot of the things Bob made up, he'd make a song up and Monty say, what's the name of that one? He goes, I have no idea. I just did it. And he'd change it. And he'd take a popular song and change it his way. So we just played. That's all we did.
The Golden Chords played at the Hibbing Moose Club and at a local barbecue joint. One time they rented the Hibbing Armory and sold tickets for 50 cents apiece. It's believed that was Bob's first paying gig. In 1959, he graduated from high school and wrote in his yearbook that his ambition was to join Little Richard.
Well, it's Saturday night and I just got paid. Fool about my money, don't try to save. My heart say go, go, have a time, cause it's Saturday night and I'm feeling fine. I'm gonna rock it out. I'm gonna rip it out. I'm gonna shake it out. Gonna burn it up. I'm gonna rock it out. And ball tonight.
You're listening to Boy from the North Country, Bob Dylan in Minnesota. I'm Jim Bickle. In 1959, Bob enrolled in the University of Minnesota. That's where he reconnected with his old friend from summer camp, Dick Cohn.
He was interested in living outside of a dorm, and his parents wanted him to live in a dorm. And he wound up living in a fraternity house, a Sigma Alpha Mu fraternity house, where I was also a member. And he definitely was not a fraternity member. He was not a pledge, even though he lived in the house, and I think that was part of the requirement, sort of, but he was definitely not into the fraternity scene. I would be coming to school at 9 o'clock in the morning. He'd be coming home from being out all night. And his room at the fraternity was really a great room. He did a drawing in pencil on the wall of a 6-foot-high, tall picture of a face, and he kept improving the mouth, and it was erased, and it was, and I can see it in my mind to this day. I wish I owned it. The house has been torn down long ago.
The people that Bob was encountering at the University of Minnesota were not listening to rock and roll. Folk and authentic blues is what the aspiring musicians there were listening to. One of them was Dave Ray.
Well, now, put a mama, tell me what's on your mind. How come you're doing this so unkind? Hey, hey, mama, baby, won't you stop that thing one time with me? Hey, hey, mama, won't you stop that thing?
One of the people that was part of the local music scene in the campus community of Dinkytown was a woman named Marilyn Matheny.
I would say that John Kerner and Dave Ray were considered the stars. They were really clearly very talented. They were just soaking up music, learning quickly, had a lot of charisma on stage, and everybody quite admired them.
Spider John Kerner has this memory of his first encounter with the man who is now calling himself Bob Dylan.
The memory I have was a bunch of us, half a dozen or so, bought some wine, and we went on back in the back of the chemistry building. There was a loading dock back there, And, you know, we had our guitars and sat around and played and sang. It was the beginning of a time, quite a bit of time in Dinkytown when we all got to know each other and hang out and perform together and so on.
At the time, Marilyn Matheny lived in an apartment above the 10 o'clock Scholar, a local coffee house.
Most of the men, not most of them, but at least half of the men in the group that I hung out with, were really enamored of folk music. And they were learning to play guitars, almost all of them, and learning chords, first of all, and then learning songs and swapping songs and learning from each other. And they'd get together and either in our apartment or in other apartments or the 10 o'clock Scholar. And the owner of the Scholar at that point decided that if he had some of these people come in and play music, that maybe that would bring more customers in. So he would enlist. I don't know that he paid anything, or if he did, it was very little to have these people come in. Well, Bob Dylan arrived and was hanging around with the same group of people, very interested in what they were doing, but very introverted and rather shy and didn't say a lot.
Another woman who knew Bob Dylan at the time was Ellen Simer. We reached her via Skype from her home in Switzerland. She told us what it was like to date Bob Dylan.
He never washed, and he had really hideous teeth. And the idea of kissing somebody with his green teeth was kind of like, how would you want to do that? But nevertheless, he did have something that was quite attractive about him. But it was very focused on him, very definitely. He was a fascinating person who had an ability to get things from people, even though he was an extraordinarily selfish person.
What he really wanted from Ellen Simer was access to her father's record collection. Her father, Mike Baker, was the president of the Minneapolis Folklore Society and had a huge collection of folk music, songs that Bob had never heard before.
Bob could not get enough of listening to Cisco Houston, and I think there was another singer, which could have been Woody Guthrie, singing Those Brown Eyes. He played it over and over again.
Those brown eyes I love so well.
Ellen Simer's father, Mike Baker, was very protective of his records. But Marilyn Matheny recalls that when he had the chance, Bob Dylan had no qualms about helping himself to other people's records.
We're at a party at just over our apartment, a friend of ours who lived just over our apartment. And it was late, and we were all had too much to drink, and we were on our way to a bar. So, of course, where do you go when you have too much to drink but a bar? He said, just a minute, wait, he said, you know, watch the door for me. And he stuck some records in his knapsack. And he said, he's got so many, he's not going to miss them anyway. So he did, you know, and I was kind of alarmed because this was a friend of mine, and yet he was a friend of mine, and I felt really torn in this position of, what do I do?
A collection that Bob clearly coveted was Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music. He loved listening to songs like this one, Penny's Farm, recorded in 1929 by the Bentley Boys.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, listen to the song. Sang it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. May make you mad, but I mean no harm. It's just about the renter's own Penny's Farm. It's the hard times in the country out on Penny's Farm. You move out on Penny's Farm, plant a little crop of bagger and a little crop of corn. Come around and see you're gonna flit and plot till you get yourself a mortgage on everything you got. It's the hard times in the country out on Penny's Farm.
And later, while he was living in New York, Bob Dylan was inspired to write his own take on that song.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, and listen to my song. Sing it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. Just a little glimpse of a story I'll tell about an East Coast city that you all know well. It's hard times from the country living down in New York town. Old New York City is a friendly old town. From Washington Heights to Harlem on down, there's a mighty many people in the middle and all around. They'll kick you when you're up and knock you when you're down. It's hard times from the country living down in New York town.
In the Twin Cities, when Bob got gigs playing in coffee houses and pizza parlors, his old friend Dick Cohn was often in attendance.
At that time, when he was performing, he was playing at all the 10 o'clock Scholar and the Triangle and all these little coffee houses around town. And I was very into music at that time and into folk music particularly. And so I would follow him around. I would go to those events.
What was the reception like in those venues at that time? How popular was he?
Yeah, not very popular. He was just another singer, and he was also not doing a lot of original stuff then. It was a beatnik crowd at the time, and he was just one of the entertainers. I mean, there were bongo players, and there were other types of music too. So he wasn't didn't have a great fan base. I mean, he was just a good performer, you know.
It sounds like he was just sort of learning folk music at that time, right?
Well, exactly. I think he was learning stage presence a little bit. I mean, he was always into the music part of it, but I think he was learning about performing in front of people.
1960, a crude recording was made of Bob playing in a friend's apartment.
He had a kind of a sweet voice, actually, which is so jarring when I hear his voice as it matured. He sung a lot of ballads, nice kind of sweet, simple ballads, and didn't have a big following. But generally everybody said, well, he's got a nice voice, but he can't play guitar. So it was kind of odd when he later sang with this just raspy voice. I wasn't sure where that came from, you know, whether he damaged his voice or whether it was purposeful that he'd made that change.
Another significant thing that happened to Dylan while he lived in Minneapolis was that he fell in love with the music of Woody Guthrie.
Well, I pulled out my pencil, scribbled this song. I figured all them salmon just couldn't be wrong. And salmon fish is pretty shrewd. They got senators and politicians, too.
In his autobiography, Chronicles, Dylan describes what it felt like one afternoon when he sat down and listened to nothing but Guthrie music. He writes, all these songs together, one after another, made my head spin. It made me want to gasp.
I've been laying out 90 days way down the road.
I had heard Guthrie before, but mainly just a song here and there, mostly things that he sang with other artists. I hadn't actually heard him, not in this earth-shattering kind of way. I couldn't believe it.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land. Hard-working man and brave, he said to the...
Guthrie had such a grip on things. He was so poetic and tough and rhythmic. There was so much intensity, and his voice was like a stiletto.
Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter...
Ellen Simer recalls Dylan expressing his devotion to Guthrie during a party at her house.
And on that front yard of 2012 Girard Avenue South, just before he went to New York, he was drunk. And he was going around on the yard and then going down the street calling out, Woody, I'm coming, Woody, Woody.
It wasn't long before he was on his way to New York in search of Woody Guthrie. Marilyn Matheny recalls that before he left, he was not the most popular man in Dinkytown.
He was not completely straightforward with us. He made up stuff. He wanted to be somebody and he wanted to be bigger than he was. And there was a period when Bobby was really kind of, everyone was dumping on him. They were just so hard on him. And he'd either done or said some things that had really annoyed people. And one of the things he did was he went on this trip. He was going to go on this big trip to, I think, to Colorado and sing in this famous place. And he ran out of money or something and ended up washing dishes in North Dakota. So the story goes. But when he came back, no one believed him that he had really gone on this trip or done these things. And they just thought he was making stuff up, you know, so they kind of dumped on him a lot. And I felt bad for him during that time. It was just not good. And he left not long after that and probably has some bitter feelings about how he was treated there. And I don't blame him for that.
4th Street is the main street in Dinkytown, and it's not a stretch to conclude that Bob was thinking about his old buddies back in Minneapolis when he wrote Positively 4th Street.
I know the reason that you talk behind my back.
such a fool to think I'd make contact with one who tries to hide what it don't know to begin with. You see me on the street, you always act surprised. You say, how are you? Good luck, but you don't mean it.
You're listening to Boy from the North Country, Bob Dylan in Minnesota. I'm Jim Bickle. In January of 1961, Dylan moved to New York and quickly became immersed in the Greenwich Village folk scene, and his singing and guitar playing and songwriting abilities improved dramatically. Dylan even likened it to the old legend of the blues musician who goes to the crossroads and makes a deal with the devil for great talent. He talked about that during Martin Scorsese's documentary, No Direction Home.
That's when I went to the crossroads and made a big deal. You know, like, yeah, one night, and then went back to Minneapolis, and I was like, hey, where's this guy been? You know, he'd been to the crossroads.
Dylan visited Minneapolis less than a year after he'd moved away, and fellow musician Tony Glover was really impressed by how much he'd improved. Glover recorded Dylan performing in a friend's apartment.
I was young when I left home, thought I'd been out of rambling around. And I never wrote a letter to my home, to my home, Lord, to my home. And I never wrote a letter to my home.
1961 turned out to be a real turning point in Dylan's career. Late that year, he signed a recording deal with Columbia Records. Back in Hibbing, Leroy Hoikala recalls being at work at Feldman's department store and getting a message that Bob's father wanted to see him.
Mr. Feldman, Herman came and said, Leroy, he says, go to Mike Electric. They want to talk to you. I'll show you something. I said, okay, great. So I went over there, and Abe was over there, and he says, come here, look at this, look at this, you got to see this. And he had a Harry Belafonte record. He said, listen, who's playing harmonica on this? And it was Bob. So he was really proud of him.
So let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me.
Nancy Peterson had a job at Feldman's department store as well. That's where she became friends with Bob's mother.
Bob's mother, Beattie, was the sweetest, most gregarious person I think I've ever met. She sold women's dresses at Feldman's department store, and she cared about everybody. She had known my mom, and she had liked her, and so when I got a part-time job and worked at Feldman's for quite a few years, Beattie was my best friend in the store, and she always asked about me and my family. And then as her son became active in the music industry, she would tell me things about him. I got a postcard from Bob. He's traveling here and there. I do remember when she told me that her son was dating Joan Baez. And to me, Joan Baez was the most wonderful singer there had ever been. And so that was a big sign that Bob was hitting the big time, I thought.
Dylan's first album was mostly covers of traditional folk songs, but it was his second album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, that really established him as a writer and a star in the folk music scene. It wasn't long before he was being called the voice of his generation.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Even though he was living in New York, Dylan didn't leave his Minnesota roots behind, and you can hear it in his music. Dave Pekaski is a professor at Southwest State University in Marshall. He says you can hear the Iron Range accent in songs like Blowin' in the Wind.
If you listen closely, an S that makes a plural sound is a Z sound, cars, boys. But if you get up onto the range, it's a non-voiced, it's a cars, years. And if you listen to ears and years in there, how many ears, how many years, it's not that voiced Z, and that's that Midwest voice coming in that song.
Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Pekaski is the author of North Country Blues, a Midwest framework for the songs of Bob Dylan. He says many of the words and pronunciations and themes in Bob Dylan's music are drawn from the place that he grew up. And you can hear it in songs like North Country Blues, which is all about the Iron Range.
Come and gather round, friends, and I'll tell you a tale of when the red iron ore pits run aplenty, but the cardboard filled windows and old men on the benches. Tell you now that the whole town is empty.
This is a song about the closing of the mines, the shutting down of the employment opportunities, and people kind of leaving up there. But there's a lot of layers underneath there. Other than the economics, there's this us-them, you know, the man come to speak, and he said in a week number 11 is closing. He comes from out east. And there's this antagonism. Dylan said at one point they hated Eastern mine owners a lot more than they hated communists up there on the range. So that's buried in the song there.
Then the shaft was seen shut and my work was cut. And the fire in the air, it felt frozen. Tell a man come to speak, and he said in 1 week. That number 11 was closing. They complain in the east, they're paying too high. They say that your ore ain't worth digging, that it's much cheaper down in the South American towns, where the miners work almost for nothing.
In 1974, Dylan bought some property in a rural area less than an hour's drive from the Twin Cities. It's a place he would come in the summer to spend time with his family. In 1975, he was at the farm and listening to some of the songs he had recorded and was planning to release on the album Blood on the Tracks.
So now I'm going back again. I got to get to her somehow. All the people we used to know, they're an illusion to me now. Some are mathematicians, some are doctors' wives. Don't know how it all got started, don't know what they're doing with their lives. But me, I'm still on the road, heading for another joint. We always did feel the same, we just saw it from a different point of view. Kind of
Dylan didn't like the way about half of the track sounded. Now, his brother, David, was also in the music business. He was a producer in the Twin Cities. So Dylan asked him to assemble a group of local musicians to re-record some of the tracks. One of them was guitarist Kevin Odegaard.
We were sitting on the ledge playing with Tangled Up in Blue in the key of G, and it was just kind of laying there. It wasn't doing much. It was okay. And Bob turned to me, and in an unguarded moment, he said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, it's passable." He stood up and paced around a little bit, looked around and wondered if we might have an idea to, you know, to move it up a key. My suggestion was to move it from G to A, to give a little more energy, to give a little more punch, to give a little more bite. He wouldn't try it at first. Then he looked around the room, and my mates gave me a vote of confidence. He started seeing head shaking. So he turned and looked at me, and he said, okay, let's give it a try. And we did, and it worked. And about a third of the way through the first verse, he cut the take, and he just looked in at Paul Martinson, and he said, well, let's roll this. This is happening. And we rolled it, and that's what you hear on the record. There's no mix. There's nothing. That was it.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's bankbook wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue.
Peter Ostrushko also played on the Minneapolis sessions. He told Minnesota Public Radio's Kathy Werzer that he took the job despite the fact that he had walking pneumonia.
As we got there, they were already packing up. They were packing up their stuff. And someone came up, Brett Dillon, over and introduced us, and we met him. And he looked at my instruments. I had a fiddle and a mandolin with me. And he said, what's this one? And I said, that's a mandolin. He said, oh, well, you know, I think there's a song I'd like to do that mandolin would sound real good on. So everyone pulled their instruments out again, and he taught us this song, If You See Her, Say Hello. And we recorded it. I went home, went back to bed, got up in the morning, and I had a fever the whole time. You know, I mean, I really
was. So you're still thinking this is a dream? Is that
Yeah, I woke
you're
up
delirious?
In the morning thinking it was a dream.
Oh.
And I called my friend down at the podium, Jim, and I said, Jim, you wouldn't believe this dream I had last night. And he listened to me describe this tale, and he said, buddy, that's no dream. You were there.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier. She left here last early spring. Is living there, I say for me that I'm all right, though things get kind of slow. She might think that I've forgotten her, though tell her it isn't so.
You're listening to Boy from the North Country, Bob Dylan in Minnesota. I'm Jim Bickle. Outside of his immediate family, one of the few people that Bob Dylan kept in touch with from his Minnesota days was Larry Keegan.
Larry Keegan was one of Bob's only true friends. I never saw Bob talk or be with anybody, like he was with Larry.
Dick Cone knew Larry and Bob from their time together at summer camp. Gene LaFon was another friend of Larry's. He says Larry actually performed on the first record that Bob ever made.
In St. Paul, there used to be a place, a music store, where you could go make a record for $5. And Bob used to come down from Hibbing and stay with Larry on the weekends. And they loved doo-wop songs. And they went to this music store and paid their $5. And there was a piano in the room. And they sat down, and Bob banged on the piano, and they sang these doo-wop songs. And I think there's 6 or 8 songs on it. And you can tell it's Bob, and you can tell it's Larry, and I think they were 15 years old at the time.
But Larry's life would take a dramatic turn soon after he made this record. It happened while his family was on vacation in Florida.
He met some young guy that was diving off a wall into the water, and the guy kind of egged him into doing it. He was a young kid. And he says, come on, you can do this. And Larry didn't realize that you had to wait for the waves to come in for the water to be high enough. He jumped off this wall, timed it wrong, and landed in 3 feet of water and broke his neck. And somehow, somebody was there to help him get him out of there and save his life.
While Larry was adjusting to life in a wheelchair, Bob was becoming an international star. The next time Larry heard from him was when Bob was recovering from his own injuries. Dick Cohn tells that story.
He was in a motorcycle accident in upstate New York and was told that he might be paralyzed from this accident. And at that time, he made contact with Larry again to say, Larry, you know, I remembered, thought a lot about you because I was almost paralyzed. And Larry said, you know, Bob, where you been for the last 10 years? That's not the way you treat a friend. Let's get together. And at that point, it kind of rekindled the friendship. And so Bob would call Larry and say, hey, I'm going on tour. I'm going to up and down the East Coast. You want to come? And Larry would say, absolutely. And he'd get in the van and he would drive out there and he would take people with him. Myself was someone he would take, another friend named Gene LaFond, who's another great musician here in town now.
First time I went out with Larry was 1975 for the Rolling Thunder tour, which was just incredible. You know, it was a magical thing because it had this carnival atmosphere, and they were all dressed and painted, and he was like this shaman leader of the whole thing. He had so many different people on stage and great musicians, and it was really a magical thing.
In addition to following Bob on tour, Larry traveled to Durango, Mexico, where Bob had a part in the Sam Peckinpah Western Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Here's the trailer.
James Coburn.
Bill!
Chris Christopherson.
Come on in, Pat!
And introducing in his first dramatic motion picture performance, recording star Bob Dylan. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Legends in their own time. But time was running out.
Larry was invited by Bob down to the shooting where Chris Christopherson was and Sam Peckinpah was there. And Larry lived in Mexico part of his life and spoke Spanish fluently and had these Mexican kids working with him all the time, helping him. I think Bob was very comfortable knowing that Larry spoke Spanish fluently and was very aware of what to do in Mexico, how to live on the streets, so to speak, versus as a tourist. And so Larry and Bob were very, very close there.
This is called Romance in Durango. Remember Durango, Larry? Hot chili peppers in the blistering sun. Dust on my face and my cape. Me and Magdalena on the run. I think this time we shall escape. Sold my guitar to the baker's son for a few crumbs and a place to hide. But I can get another one.
Larry Keegan was a performer as well. They were on tour and they were traveling out east, and Bob asked Larry if he would come up and sing a song. And Larry was nervous, needless to say, and worked on it for days and was really worried about it. But he went up, got up on stage, and he sang No Money Down is what he sang. And Bob played the saxophone behind it. The only time ever that anybody ever heard or saw him play a saxophone.
So I eased on my brake. He pulled out the drive. Got my money twice. And I stepped inside. The dealer came to me. Said, trade in that Ford. And I put you in a car. They were eating up the road.
In 1990 and 91, Larry and guitarist Gene LaFon played at the Bridge School benefit that Neil Young organizes for charity every year. After they performed, Larry spoke to the crowd.
You know, I just want to say that, you know, the biggest handicap that disabled people have to deal with, adults and children alike, are mainly the perceptions and attitudes of other people. Yeah, they say the human body is God's greatest masterpiece. But I have learned never to underestimate the power of the human spirit.
Over the years, as Larry's health deteriorated, he wasn't able to travel with Dylan anymore. On September 11, 2001, as the world was learning of the terrorist attacks on America, Larry had a heart attack and died. He was 59 years old. Because flights were grounded everywhere, Dylan wasn't able to travel to the memorial service. He did send his condolences in a telegram.
Ring them bells, sweet Martha, for the poor man's son. Ring them bells so the world will know that God is one. Oh, the shepherd is asleep where the willows weep. And the mountains are filled with lost sheep. Ring them bells for the blind and the deaf. Ring them bells for all of us who are left. Ring them bells for the chosen few who will judge the many when the game is through. Ring them bells for the time that flies, for the child that cries when our innocence dies. Ring them bells, St. Catherine, from the top of the room. Ring them from the fortress for the lilies that bloom. For the lines are long and the fighting is strong. And the breaking down the distance between right and wrong.
Since 1988, Dylan has been playing about 100 shows a year in what has been dubbed the Never-Ending Tour. In 1992, he played 5 shows in a row at the Minneapolis Orpheum Theater. Dick Cohn brought his mother to see him there for the first time.
I took my mom to the concert, and my mom, coincidentally, was a friend of Bob's mom, who lived here at the time, and they were in the same Mahjong club or something, and so they were friendly. So we went to the concert, and when we were walking out, a woman, a girl, walked up to Bob's mom and said, "What's it like knowing that you gave birth to the Messiah?" And so Beatty didn't know what to say. She just kind of ignored it and everything. And afterwards, I asked my mom what she thought about that. And she said, I don't get it. She says, I couldn't understand one word he said.
Said the little lamb to the shepherd boy, "Do you hear what I hear? Ringing through the sky, shepherd boy. Do you hear what I hear? A song, high above the tree with a voice as big as the sea. With a voice as big as the sea."
Dylan has a reputation for not being an overly sentimental person, but he did choose a historic occasion to return to the University of Minnesota campus for the first time since he dropped out as a freshman. It was November 4th, 2008, the night that Barack Obama was elected president. University of Minnesota professor Mark Seeley was in the crowd at Northrop Auditorium.
There was little commentary from him. I remember at one point he got quite a cheer later on in the concert when he said, it looks like things are about to change. One other thing that was very striking, Jim, was you look across the audience that night, and there were people from every walk of life. There was every age range, people from any lifestyle you could think of, everybody mixed together. And that was pretty exciting just by itself.
Dylan has performed in the city where he was born, Duluth. But since he's moved away, he's never put on a show in the place where he grew up, Hibbing. Colleen Sheehy has spent a lot of time in Hibbing, putting together material for a museum exhibition about Dylan's life in Minnesota. She says Hibbing has a funny relationship with Dylan.
Some people really don't care. They don't get why people love Dylan so much and are curious and want to go to his hometown. I think there's also a feeling that he rejected Hibbing and he left Hibbing and he hasn't come back and, you know, made any big pronouncements about this town made me. So they feel a little resentful about that. But then there are people like Bob and Linda Hockian and some others who really understand Dylan's importance.
Bob and Linda Hocking were the owners of Zimmy's, a restaurant on the main drag in downtown Hibbing. It closed in 2014 after 30 years in business. In its heyday, the walls were filled with Dylan memorabilia, and it was the unofficial meeting place for people who came to Hibbing in search of Dylan's roots. Dylan fans from around the world found their way to Zimmy's, but the man himself, Bob Dylan, never set foot in the restaurant that he inspired. And since he left to attend the University of Minnesota in 1959, Dylan has never performed in the town where he grew up. Bob Hocking hopes that one day he'll return.
My dream is that he would come back, and as his last, his never-ending tour ends, it would end at the Hibbing High School where it began in his high school when they had their high school convocation. He did Little Richard. It would be a dream come true if he came back and he played his last concert at Hibbing High School.
Every step of the way, we walk the line. Your days are numbered, so are mine. Time is piling up, we struggle and we scrape. All boxed in, nowhere to escape. City's just a jungle.
You've been listening to Boy from the North Country, Bob Dylan in Minnesota. With production assistance from Curtis Gilbert and Megan Multenny, I'm Jim Bickle.
I was raised in the country, been working in the town. I've been in trouble since I set my suitcase down.